We appreciate being able to gather here at Messiah, so thank you so much. When I first met Dietmar and we began to talk a little bit, I had the pleasure of listening to him think about his relationship, of course, to teaching, to preaching, to Augustana, to the church, to Africa, to Mexico, to students above all, and very quickly sensed the echo in that of his mother and father. And so really encouraged Dietmar to reflect on his vocation and the way in which he'd lived that out. And he, as some of you will know, some of you no doubt were there, he has given two lectures in the past reflecting on aspects of that legacy. And tonight, I wanted him to give the third one, which is to pull that forward and look at its impact on both theology and pedagogy. At this point in the history of Augustana and the history of the university, there is at least in certain quarters serious thinking about what it is we're up to in our teaching of the young. And Dietmar, both as a intellectual and as a professor, has not only thought about these things, but acted on them in a way that's remarkable. So I'm delighted that he's doing this tonight, and that you've all gathered for this, and that we can listen and engage in what is a blessed patrimony that has blessed this world and several other worlds as well. So, Dietmar. Thank you.
Well, thank you all for coming, especially for those of you who are traveling long distances. It was a great surprise to see Edmontonians brave the weather or the roads or the night to be here, or others from around here. So thank you for coming. It's lovely. It's an impossible assignment, so I won't be able to do what David gave me as an assignment. I mean, if we had lots of hours, you know, maybe. So I'll do a tiny bit of that and talk a tiny bit initially only about my theology and pedagogy, but the major assignment is sort of to trace a bit the impact of my parents on that. And so I will do that more in snapshots of how my parents lived out their faith rather than, I can't trace their spiritual journey, that's internal to them in many ways. But obviously, as children, we had a fair amount of experiences, you know, with them. So for me, if you want to call it, what's emerging for me is more a theology of hope, but a theology of hope in the midst of our captivity to socially and ecologically destructive systems and patterns. And so that in itself is a challenge. So very quickly, and some of you who've been in these classes know that well enough, hope is not false optimism. You know, it's basically, well, everything will turn out okay somehow, or, you know, we look at some of these lovely young people here and say, you are our hope for the future, which basically means we as adults have given up, or as older adults, let's say. We've given up, you know, we screwed up, we've made an ecological, social mess of so many things in the world, and now we're just throwing this all over to you, and that's, you are our hope. Yeah, that's not for me. I think that's actually false optimism, or it's another version of apathy. This is a way of not getting engaged. But the hope that I'm trying to talk about goes together with amazing amount of bad stuff happening in the world. Like if you take, you know, you're a tiny bit more of my family history, but if you take the family history, if you take human history, if you take the biblical history, amazing amount of empires fall. Millions of people die. And so the issue, and the Bible is a book of hope. So and hope is considered one of the theological virtues, you know, faith, hope, and love. These are the theological virtues. These are gifts. And ultimately, it says, humans cannot live without hope. So, hope in a certain sense is our will for the future. And if we don't have a will for the future, I think then we are sort of broken. But at the same time, how do you do it and keep your eyes wide open? Right? So one way of trying to keep being hopeful is just basically, you know, you turn on happy television hours or, you know, be happy, don't worry, or whatever version of life you do. But that's not hope. Right? That is actually despair. I have to numb myself. And we probably all have to numb. I can appreciate people who numb through substances or any number of ways of numb themselves. It is overwhelming what's going on in the world. But ultimately, hope means you are willing to look at, if you want, our present darkness, the darkness that exists in our society, but you do it ultimately without despair. That doesn't mean you don't have moments of being overwhelmed or despairing or whatever. So how do we work on that? And the other thing is, in the Christian tradition, and that's the tradition I grew up in and I'm in, the central part of the Christian tradition is the death and resurrection of Jesus, so that even out of death, and maybe only through certain versions of death and dying, does life get drawn forth. So I think that's the other part of hope, that again, you know, that's not this happy, happy skimming on the surface, but actually, well, how do you draw life out of very death-dealing situations? That's the David Goa phrase, by the way. I've listened too much to David, I think, or we've team-talked too many times. Hope it has to always be active. As a matter of fact, and this is a phrase from David, from Chris Hedges, if you do not act, you don't have hope. With other words, to, you know, say I'm very hopeful and sit back and you're not disturbed by what's going on, you basically do not have hope. You do not have a will for the future. And one thing that Carmel just found from Wendell Berry is a statement, and I won't even paraphrase it properly, but ultimately hope doesn't ask about your chances of success. You know, we were up at the Philosopher's Cafe on Saturday in Edmonton. Okay, so what gives you hope? You know, in other words, the question always seems to be, can we get it done in time, right? Okay, so we have 400 parts per million, so it's even higher than when Bill McKibben was here in the atmosphere. So it's beyond actually what a stable environment, you know, what can maintain a stable environment and allows creatures and plants and animals to adapt rapidly enough. So then the question is always, well, what are your chances of success, basically? And it's actually another way of asking the question of despair. Is it even worth doing anything? Is really what stands behind that question, right? And, you know, I'll bring it up at the end again, maybe it's good enough to do it here. I mean, Luther's response for that is, if the world should end tomorrow, I would still plant an apple tree today. And in the last two decades of my father's life, he died at age 92. I mean, we grew up in an orchard, so it wasn't an apple tree, but he planted trees after trees after trees, which my poor sister somehow has to figure out how to... We're in the desert, right? So how do you maintain these lovely trees? But they're seeding themselves, and lots of wildlife is growing there. Anyhow, but this theology of hope, then, is the touchstone, if you want, for my pedagogy, my way of teaching. And I definitely can't blame my parents on it, or something, for my way of teaching. Obviously, I'm very influenced also by Paulo Freire. You know, I've read all of his versions, but the one that would be relevant and is not as depressing as The Pedagogy of the Oppressed is The Pedagogy of Hope. And of course, his Pedagogy of Oppressed is a pedagogy of hope. How do you help people to name their world and take responsibility and be engaged and act, to create health for themselves, create community, heal the land, you know, that's all part of the pedagogy. So avoid oppression in its many ways. Maybe John Ralston Saul puts it well, what we have to do is overcome being an unconscious civilization. And it really is actually quite scary when you walk down streets at night and everybody has some glimmering thing, you know, going on. And sure, I mean, we can be entertained by Olympics and by many other things as well. But what does it do collectively? Is that another whole layer of numbing us rather than letting us live with eyes wide open or alert or engaged? And it used to be, and this is why our children loved my parents, we would entertain ourselves. And the biggest entertainment, actually, although it's pretty horrific, is tell me when you fled. You know, tell me when Papa had diarrhea, which was during the fleeing. And, of course, you know, we got caught at that point. We could have been shot. So that wasn't so much. Anyway, but that was exciting, right? So exciting stuff in the family history. And it is entertaining at the same time. It's serious and entertaining. And, of course, you have the comfort. Your grandparents are telling you these stories, and you're sitting there, and you just listen to their stories. So you know somehow there is some version of happy ending because we're all sitting here, right? So you have that security in a certain sense. That it doesn't mean that relatives didn't die. But the challenge then for teaching with a pedagogy of hope is how do we face the darkness of the present time without despairing? And, you know, Sarah and I here have had conversations and many others about this. It's pretty overwhelming what's going on in the world. So how, as a class or how, as an instructor, do you find the balance without eliminating what's actually going on? And by the way, the older adults aren't any better. They just try to tune out. It's too hard what's going on in our world. Anyhow, so one of our many sensitive stories as students after reading Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt by Chris Hedges, you know, was sharing with another student, a recent grad from Augustana, you know, I don't know, you know, I can't handle this, you know, and the student said, no, just stay with it, and I guarantee you the course won't just leave you there, right? So we're often not willing to go into, and she was just overwhelmed, how can humans, just for profit, do things like locking people up in containers, you know, in the tomato fields in southern Florida, so that Canadians can have nice tomatoes and Americans and many other people can have nice tomatoes in, you know, in the winter. You know, how can humans do that to humans? I mean, it's just horrific what's going on, all on the name of either corporate advancement or profit or whatever, right? So how can we do that? And or the mountaintop removal or fracking here in Alberta, how can we destroy our water? How can we blow up mountains, right? Which also destroys the Gulf of Mexico, of course, right? The acidification, you know, the 17% increase of acidification in the oceans is partly because of mountaintop removal and all this kind of stuff. Well, I said, how can we do it? It's overwhelming when you think about it, right? So how do you teach without that, okay, we're overwhelmed or we just numb out? And obviously talking at people, as I'm doing right now, can't be the major mode. And so, you know, gradually over the years, you know, I've developed, I don't know, it's not even techniques. You know, there's a whole way of trying to approach. What we have to do is ultimately generate community, right? Communities of support, communities where we mutually, you know, heal each other. A course that Carmel and Tiff and I will be doing in Victoria and Vancouver coming up is basically saying, how can we be motivated by affection rather than by fear? And a phrase of Vincent Erickson that I've been quoting all my professional career ever since I heard it from him is, how do we avoid defensive apathy? The issues are so big, and so we, as defense, just drop into apathy. So how do we avoid that? And I think ultimately we have to be motivated by affection. You know, and for us as grandparents, it's relatively easy. You know, you have affection for your kids, and you have affection for your grandkids, and you want them to have a life, right, that is worth living. So what do we do? Right, but I think that's what we have to cultivate in each other, is this version of affection. So what happened for me in working on, well, how do we move from the head, or combine head and heart? Head's a good thing. I'm a head person. I'm a 6 on the Enneagram or whatever. So, okay, for those of you who work in that language. But knowledge by itself can create an amazing disease And again, I was born in Nazi Germany. And they had some of the top universities. And they had good musicians. And in spite of having the top universities and top intellectuals, and people knew their science, then they knew their philosophy, they had their Heideggers and whatever, Nazism, in such a rapid, I mean, if you really read the history, it's within months of Hitler taking power after January of 1933 that, you know, faculty members were dismissed because they were Jewish or their grandmother was Jewish or whatever, right? So that was enough, and nobody did anything. So how can we be so blind? Right? So knowledge by itself doesn't do it. So Pascal had that famous phrase, like, the heart has its reason, which reason does not know. So we have to connect to the heart. We have to connect to what the heart attaches itself to. And ultimately, we have to cultivate affection. So for me, it meant moving out of the classroom. I mean, I stayed in the classroom quite a bit, but at least for 20 of the students, they spent their whole 8 month academic months out of the classroom in rural Alberta and then in rural Mexico. And some of you know through the Prairie Mexico Rural Development Program. And then when Carson took it over, it became the Puebla Alberta Community Service Exchange. But we discovered that actually you can do way more multiple teaching at the same time. So as we're puzzling at the university, how do we do it? Well, that's how you create a cohort. You sit in the Zocalo. I'd say just ship them all to Mexico and let the Mexican campesina women, you know, I think they'll teach people how to be humans and whatever and how to deal with grief and suffering and joy and the whole ball of wax. But, you know, you're sitting on a Zocalo, you're sitting on a tree, you know, under a tree, the big amate trees, or you're sitting on a rock and you'll be discussing, sorry, diarrhea. You know, maybe you should take Portichosa for this. You'll be discussing their academic project. You'll be discussing their career choices. I mean, it's all intermingled. And we're looking at ecological and economic and political, social and cultural issues at the same time. We didn't say, okay, well, now you better go to a specialist in environment and now, you know, take some courses in economics. Those are all good to take. But it's actually, these are the big issues that you're facing. How does a community survive? And the community of Amatlam had survived for 4,000 years. Or where Alex was next door, whatever, 10 minutes from Amatlan, San Andres de la Cal had survived for many, many years. I don't know whether any of our rural communities would say, well, in 4,000 years, we can still plant our corn and our frijoles, our beans, and our squash together, and the earth still produces to feed us. Like it was, you know, initially it was development studies. Like, we had to be developed and we had to study. It isn't, you know, initially, of course, when students were fundraising, they were trying to say, well, we're going to Ghana initially, and then, you know, and, well, it's more the reporters. The students weren't quite as foolish, I hope, because we tried to orient them beforehand. You know, so-and-so is going to Ghana and will, you know, and will develop it. Yeah. Okay, that's nice. Okay, I think some of these people have lived for a bit. You know, it's nice that you are going to develop Ghana or you're going to develop, you know, Mexico or this Mexican village, you know. Yeah, if development means having a few more plastic, you know, whatever, toys in the public square, yeah, maybe, whatever. But if that's not your notion of development, then anyhow. But, you know, and when students said, well, what should we say? And I said, well, the right answer is we're going to go to learn from Mexican peasants. That doesn't raise a lot of funds because it challenges our notion of superiority, that we actually have to learn from humble peasants, you know, and they're the survivors. You know, they wouldn't use the word poor. The majority of them would never use the word poor to describe their existence. They're living. You know, our students say, well, when do you go shopping? Shopping? You know, our beans are over here. This big partly adobe, partly straw container that holds their corn, that's over there. Sure, there's certain things. Café Americano for the Canadian students, you know, or whatever, they'll go with that. Otherwise, they do café de olla, which is the coffee up in the pot, which they raise their own coffee. You know, they roast it, they grind it, they boil it with cinnamon, you know, and it's an amazing drink. But, of course, for the guests, they have Café Americano, which is basically instant coffee. It's pretty yucky stuff, you know, the worst stuff that you can get in any store. But anyhow, but to honor their guests, you know, that will be bought. So it's an amazing way of learning. But in the long run, I discovered, learning in community, and of course they become a community. We called ourselves the Institute of International Matrimony after a while. There's a lot of international marriages. I think 4 international or 5 international ones, probably maybe 15. I don't know whether Carsten kept track. Somebody should keep track of how many marriages emerged from that. Well, it makes sense. Like if you're really working together and you're cultivating affection for a place and for each other, you know, and if you're at the proper age, somewhere between 19 and 29 is what we had, you know, sure, that can also happen, right? So, anyhow. So, initially it was out of the classroom, and again, the language shifted, and Carsten and I wrote on that in a little piece, is how do we reconnect people to themselves, to the land, and to community? That's a pedagogy of hope. Right, the task is of how to reconnect and at the same time liberate us from either unconsciousness of the unconscious civilization or liberate us to the extent that we can from these structures that make us hyper-individualist or that pull our communities apart or that destroy the natural basis from which we live, right? But after a while I discovered actually you can do it here in Camrose. And some of you guys who are here are assigned. It can be done here in Camrose. In other words, we could actually create a community between community members and credit students, right? And we've done that through the Ronning Center for years, but that's part of a pedagogy of hope, right? Let's not have these walls between, okay, this is the academic institution, we do very profound stuff, and, well, yeah, sure, the community members probably have more degrees than a lot of us, but still, rather than, we can mentor each other, or we can animate each other, right? It's just fun to have students around and their freshness of questions and perceptions and whatever. And so we discovered, hey, we can cook excellent food together. So the last class, Spirit of the Land, you know, there was always a group of 6. And, of course, we had the Trevas and the Lindas and, you know, lots of other people, Allens, around. I'm sure I'm missing some people with my eyesight. But, you know, and students and community members hosted sort of people doing their cooking adventure. And it was amazing food. It got better actually as the semesters progressed. I don't know whether there's a bit of competition going on here. Anyhow, the food was amazing, but the amount of community it builds when people actually eat together and chat together beyond the specific topic of the day. But the other thing that we did is people actually gathered as reflection partners. And somebody had alerted me that actually institutionally I can't require that. Okay, well, I'm glad I didn't know the institutional requirements. You can't require people to meet as groups outside of class. Anyhow, it was a requirement. And everybody chose a reflection partner and or several reflection partners. It was not the dean who informed me of this. It was somebody else. And I said, well, people who cannot technically meet, like people who were commuting it from Hobima, we found solutions, right? I mean, there's many ways you can find solutions when this doesn't work for everybody. But this is probably one of the better ways for you to learn. Reflect personally, and then reflect with each other on what you have read. And everybody was reading Hope Beneath Our Feet. That was one of the textbooks. So we discovered, yes, we can create a community, and then all our fracking students, you know, who did the responsibility for the land conference, 7 students, each one taking credit in some different area, but it got amazingly focused on, this is a real issue, we have to tackle it, right? And it's carrying on. It's going in, albertavoices.ca emerged in the long run out of that, and that's carrying on as another project. Talk to Hans after, or James, or anybody else involved in that. But that's act of hope. Out of this community emerges an energy, and we give credit for environmental studies, for religious studies, for political studies, and for interdisciplinary studies, all for amongst those 7 students who were focusing on fracking. So there are real communities. So next year, then, when we did the Spirit of the Land conference, everyone was there, wasn't it? I think every single one of the 7 students were there. So they had to come from Peru, from Turkey via Calgary, from Calgary doing their studies, etc. They all came back to support this Spirit of the Land, building a community land ethic. Again, how do we reconnect people to the land? How can the land learn to speak? Anyhow, enough of the pedagogy. So we can do it here. And of course, as soon as I figure out we can do it here, I have to retire. So it's good. You know, we wouldn't want this to catch at the university as a model of education, that people actually have fun together, and, you know, and enjoy learning. One student said, Oh, I love all the books you assign. I always tell all my friends to read them too. Which isn't the common experience of some people, like some of these textbooks, they, you know, you sort of drop them as quickly as you can. Anyhow, so a lot of this has been influenced, obviously, by my parents, and this will be more than half of my talk, so we're not halfway through. Sorry. My parents, and if you can't, you know, you can say time out, I'll ignore you, but you can do whatever, right? But if you have to get up, feel free. But for me, just narrating a bit, my parents as living examples of hope, and why they are significant is because they and our family went through the trauma of World War II, being displaced actually several times, being refugees, finally being immigrants to Canada. And so my parents' way of dealing with the collapse of supposedly, you know, Christian Western civilization has deeply influenced me. And, you know, living in the ruins of Dusseldorf, 85% bombed on the Rhine, that's right, the last major Allied offensive was across the Rhine. When we played in, you know, we lived a little refugee shelter on the exhibition grounds on the Rhine, we'd always be picking up live ammunition, which my parents figured wasn't the safest toy, but I mean, it was just scattered, right? I mean, you know, after you finish emptying your gun, you take that, you know, the cartridge, and it just drops, and you lower it again, right, if you're not doing machine gun, but the other stuff. And, of course, that's strewn. I mean, all the fields that we were playing in, I'm glad they didn't use landmines, you know, because, of course, they were rapidly advancing, and those people who lived in landmine country, I mean, that's, my dad rode on a landmine and was seriously damaged during the war, was in military hospital for 8 months, and till his dying days had shrapnel coming out of his leg. So they operated a bit, but they say, this is too sensitive, we can't even get out at that. So the interesting thing then for me is how also they approached their new life in Canada by not buying into, let's call it the American dream, you know, although somebody just recently wrote about the Canadian dream, I'm not quite sure what that is. Nor did they try to assimilate into the dominant culture. And when our vice principal of the school sort of scolded my dad, you know, this is was maybe our second year in Canada or maybe first year still, for speaking German to us as we were walking down Main Street, my dad turned to him and said, well, okay, so you're walking down a street in Paris. Would you speak French to your child? Of course not. But I don't think the principal made the connection that, you know, like when... Like, you speak your mother, father tongue naturally with your kids, and that might be the richness for Canada, that we're a pluralistic society rather than a monolingual, you know, monocultural one. Anyhow, so this way of non-assimilation actually has impacted me and my theology. But rather than our heading is lessons from my parents, I don't think life actually runs in lessons so much. So I think what I've shared more is images. And that certain incidents, certain images impact us, and they come back. We relive them, right? We experience them many times. And, of course, these images in a certain way show their, if you want, their faith or their worldview in practice. Right? That's how it comes out. And what they most showed is that even in the midst of very horrific circumstances, and later simply very hard circumstances, financially and otherwise, when you have six kids as immigrants in Canada and there's no jobs, you know, that's a bit of a challenge. One can still live faithful lives. One can live lives of faith. At the same time, my father was always theologically reflective. So we had Jim Forrest, the head of the, what is it, In Communion is the magazine? What's the name of the... the Orthodox Peace Fellowship, so he lives just outside of Amsterdam, and he stayed at our place and saw an image of my father reading and says, well, what would he be reading? I says, well, probably Bonhoeffer, you know, and so we got into a discussion, you know, I mean, my father read an amazing amount of history and, you know, amazing about, you know, Latvia and, you know, the whole, you know, tracing it back and tracing our family's involvement back, but he was always very theologically reflective. And so he always tried to think, okay, well, what does my faith actually mean into how I farm or how I build community or how we do family? And my mother, dealing with the death of the successor to the farm, my brother who died at age 27. So my dad started reading a lot of books and says, resurrection can't be just a little formula, you know. In Germany, there's a certain wing, which, well, it's a pneumatic ecclesial reality, but that's, somebody says, okay, so I'm, you know, another theologian was saying, okay, so I'm standing on a German autobahn, and there's just seven people who've been killed in an instant through this accident. What does resurrection mean at this moment? You know, so my father had to seriously think, right? And he went into grief for, easily a year, and I'll get into that at the end, at the death of my brother, but he also reflected on it. What does that actually mean for my faith? What do I, not just in my head, what do I really believe, but, you know, how do I live through that, if you want? So first of all, just as a background, my parents grew up in a predominantly agnostic home. Riga, after all, was a modern industrial port city with all the joys and vices of port cities. It was part of the Hanseatic League since 1201. Our families, or branches of our family, had lived there for about 700 years until all of a sudden we had to leave in 39. And even though in agnostic homes, as a matter of fact, my maternal grandparents were really ticked off that although the pastor knew that they weren't religious, as the, you know, I'm not sure what the language was they would have used in those days. He gave a full-length sermon at their wedding, you know, so they were really, really ticked off at that. But even in this modern secular city of Riga, it was cultural Protestantism. So you still send your children to confirmation. But confirmation isn't done during puberty. You wait till people actually have their full critical faculty, so they're 16 or 17-year-olds, and actually the person who taught my mother, at least I don't know whether both in confirmation, they're a year apart, was Professor Gergenson, who was a professor of homiletics, and whom I got to know and who got me a scholarship to go to Germany many, many years later to study theology. Anyhow, so for my parents, though, taking confirmation, which gives sort of, for those of you who don't know the tradition, basically gives, in this case, from a Lutheran perspective, sort of key biblical or theological understandings or whatever, you know, of the Christian faith from a Lutheran perspective. And for my parents, in some way, it took. You know, they took it seriously from then on, you know, and they say, well, you know, we renewed our covenant of baptism, so let's live by that covenant. But in each case, there was a grandmother, so my great-grandmothers. So each one had one. My one great-grandmother was married to a philandering doctor who always stayed a bit longer in the doctor's office than was totally warranted, and was always with the same female patient. So anyhow, you have to read my grandmother's memoirs carefully to be able to detect what was actually going on, because one had nice ways of circumlocution, as I'm using right now. Anyhow, but that... So my great-grandmother, my mother's grandmother, was a woman of faith. And for my mother, she was always, in many ways, if you want, a role model or an image of how life could be lived. And my father, equally, it's Luisa Mündel, who was his human paradigm of what faith could be. We need it also in lived versions, right? And not even if even as professors teach you confirmation, that's not quite enough. And this Luisa Mündel, great-grandmother, and we have her memoirs, which are just amazing. She would sit upstairs in the, whatever, what do you call it? What's the church you work for, loft? Anyhow, high up in the church in St. Peter's. St. Peter's is the, if you look at a picture of Riga, it's the big Renaissance towers. It was the longest wooden towers. Then after it burned a few times, they're now metal. But anyhow, and so she sat in the loft and always looked down. And in those days, of course, you still had almost assigned seats. Certain families sat here and there. And she saw that the Mündel benches were usually empty. Obviously, for Christmas, Easter, it was cultural Protestantism. Everybody went, right? Baptism still occurred. People still sent their kids to confirmation. But that didn't mean that this was your active guiding principle or anything. So she said, I actually prayed, you know, for my children and grandchildren, you know, all my life. You know, she was writing this in her memoirs in 82 or more. Anyhow, so those were other influences. But as a couple, they were very sorely tested very quickly. So they got married in 1938, and about 11 months later, my brother was born, Hans Christoph, August 24th, 1939. which was a day after Hitler, or Ribbentrop and Molotov had signed the Non-Aggression Pact, which prepared the way for World War One. A week later, World War Two. Let's add another one. They also went through World War One. But anyway, World War Two broke out, and 6 weeks later, so roughly on October 6th, Hitler announces in the Reichstag that we cannot have all these German ethnic splinter groups all over the place, and that we have to sort of realign it so that we can sort of basically gather those people who speak German together, which is an interesting mixture. He's confusing language and culture with political alliance or what country you belong to, you know, which is common, like, you know, and it's popular and a lot of people can use that. It's a good move. We had been Teutonic Knights or descendants of Teutonic Knights who came up there. Then we were under Polish rule, so we were Polish citizens. Then we were Swedish citizens. Then after the Nordic Wars of 1721, we were Russian citizens till 1918, in November 1918, when Latvia became independent at the end of sort of the Russian Revolution and end of the war. And then we were Latvians. My dad had to serve in Latvian military service. Linguistically, it was always German, but of course he also spoke, my grandparents all spoke Russian in their civil roles, and my parents had to do their graduation and, of course, speak Latvian in any public, you know, office, etc., etc. So for Hitler to say we need all these German splinter groups, you know, to sort of Heimins Reich, come home into the big realm, the thousand-year realm that he was creating, was a bit of a misnomer, let's say. So 6 weeks after the war breaks out, that means about 7 weeks after my brother was born, they had to renounce their citizenship, the 12 properties the Mundels owned, and liquidate everything and then move into German-occupied Poland. The other option was to go to Siberia, so they chose German-occupied Poland. I mean, there's a lot of cultural, obviously, links and, you know, a lot of relatives in Germany. And So with my brother, then three of us were born there in German-occupied Poland. And in 1945, then, January 1945, the Soviet army was advancing very rapidly, and already thousands, if not millions, of people from East Prussia and areas further east were fleeing past our estate, Groslowa, where I had been born. And my grandfather, as the only, you know, in the 60s, male, everybody had been drafted, of course, by the German government, asked permission. We had actually a group of pilots, a Fliegerhorst, I don't know what the English translation is, a nest of pilots, flyer's nest or whatever, on our estate. And he asked the officer, you know, permission to evacuate in an orderly way the people who were all dependent on this estate. It would not go well for them under the Soviets, and they didn't get permission. But of course, overnight, the officers themselves disappeared. Anyhow, so they had it all arranged, and they had actually some secret codes, and so they gave a code to all the other people who were managing large estates and had a lot of people that they were responsible for. And so I think we had about 48 horses and wagons for everybody who was associated with our estate. And my dad had been a horse breeder during the war as well, till he got drafted as a translator. And so we fled. Now, January in Poland is about as good as the weather today here in Camrose. And there was four of us, and I was 18 months old, and my oldest brother was five. Right? And so we're fleeing. You don't do this very rapidly. Like, the best is the pace that a horse can do, pulling a wagon. So every family got a wagon and a horse. And, of course, then the horses weren't all shod for winter walking either. And so my grandfather with horse and wagon, you know, it slipped, and a lot of people just wanted to keep on going because the Soviet army, they knew it could be within a day or whatever that they would catch up. So everybody was panicked, and some other German Baltic person just put his horse and cart across the road and said, "Stop, we'll all unharness our horses, pull Mundel's wagon on and get them back on their way." And that's how we made the first leg of our journey. We trekked for 3 weeks, made it to west of Berlin, and discovered only after the war that this wasn't far enough. West of Berlin, Stendal and Insel, was part of the Soviet zone. So you weren't actually totally safe. So then my mother, with four little ones, I was just turning two, and the diarrhea story comes in there. Anyhow, and my sister stepping into puddles and screaming, which you cannot do when you're trying to silently make it to the proper border guard who could be bribed, a Russian border guard, so you can get across the border. We made it. Yeah, we're here. That's right. So we actually, so to take the suspense away, I'm sorry. It's a spoiler alert. Anyhow, and the reason she did, she got messaged, my one aunt, young aunt, who was studying in Göttingen already at the time, when she discovered that my father and my uncle had been released as prisoners of war. My mother didn't know where my dad was from March through till end of July of 1945. She wrote daily letters. We have almost all of them. The smoochy parts have all been eliminated. But they're still nice, because most of the letters, aside from those parts, were about us as kids. So, for example, my 5-year-old brother, Christoph, who had been born in Riga still, or in Thuringsdorf outside, would always mumble, 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 and those who disobey will be shot. Because that was the message. Like, the public announcements through megaphone were always, you know, curfew is at such and such a time, you have to darken your windows, you have to do such and so, and those who disobey will be shot. So he was, you know, as a 5-year-old, you're picking this stuff up. I didn't pick up the words, I just picked up my mother's anxiety. So I've got that as my joy. Anyhow, okay, we did make it. And of course, millions of people had died. So it isn't just a story of survival. And so here's my first image, actually, from my childhood memory, because a lot of this comes out of family narrative more than my own personal memory. But we're living in this tiny refugee shelter in Düsseldorf again, right on the Rhine, and with Düsseldorf 85% in ruins. They just pushed a lot of the ruins of the buildings in the middle of the road so that some movement was possible. The streetcars did run pretty quickly to clear those tracks so that people could move around in the city. And the first Sunday of Advent comes by. Maybe time to stop. that happened a few times. And my parents were able to have a tiny little branch just an evergreen branch with a tinsel probably cut off out of the aluminum foil of cigarettes, because American cigarettes were the currency. My dad was working on the black market. How do you support your family? You sell American cigarettes? I mean, what else? I mean, it's a logical thing on the black market, obviously. I mean, millions of people died in the first 2 years after the war. There just wasn't enough food, right? And so you did everything you could. My mother went on a daily basis still to the edges of town and tried to exchange. That's the polite way of putting it. You try to exchange cigarettes for food. Begging would be another way of doing it. You just went, and some farmers were just amazing. You know, every day, some farmers put a bag of potatoes out and gave every person who came by 2 potatoes till the sack was empty. That was, you know, that was it. And so that was great excitement at our place. But anyhow, so in spite of all of that, you know, ruin and destruction, to just get a little branch. And then we got together for breakfast, and they, you know, and a lot of you know the Advent tradition, so the first of Advent, they lit a candle and had a branch. And of course, for us kids, it was this amazing beauty. You know, when you're, everything's really gray in some ways when you're living in ruins and the cities are bombed to pieces and all this kind of stuff. And in a certain sense, it would be sort of light and darkness, right? I mean, it's obviously as more an adult person reflecting on that childhood experience. But for us, it was just beautiful. But I think for my parents, it was many things. It was connecting to tradition in the midst of chaos. And it was affirming life and future. Right? That the light shines in the darkness, and they would read these texts, and the darkness has not overcome it. Right? And I'm sure we would have sung, what is the English... lift up your heads, you mighty gates, probably. Mach hoch die Tür, die Tor mach weit. Yeah, fling wide the gate. I mean, there's many English translations by now. You know, and of course, all the songs, everybody learned by memory. Like, you didn't have, okay, would you please photocopy this and, you know, or send it onto my iPad and I'll quickly, you know, I'll stare down this way. So we would be singing these songs. So every morning, during the 4 weeks of Advent, my parents got us together. We would hear a biblical verse, we would sing a song, And of course, it's their way, sure, it's a tradition, but traditions can be pretty powerful, of reflecting on their life before God. That's really what it is. Advent is the time of preparation. It's our Ramadan, if you want, but it's the time of preparation, celebrating the incarnation that God is amongst us in all this horrific stuff that has happened. And they definitely knew that there were 30 million or more people who had died around them, right? Including my mother's brother. Anyhow, so another way of putting it, it was basically a sign of hope. And my father, as he got older, he loved Fiddler on the Roof song, Tradition. You know, and sure, they did a lot of changing. I mean, they weren't rigid. But tradition actually is a way of keeping alive and using the living memory of your parents, grandparents, you know, a whole culture that supports you. How do you go through these horrific times? Anyhow, a second memory. It was in the middle of the night, about a year later, again in December, December 1st, and a strange woman, I mean, which we knew, Frau Breuer, but we didn't really know her, a neighboring woman from the neighboring refugee shelter, there was a whole string of them there on the exhibition grounds, all of a sudden came over to our place at night and stayed with us. And my father and mother disappeared in a fire truck. And then next morning, my dad came back and said, your brother Hans Holger has just been born. So I think it's a, I mean, later on I thought as an adult, maybe we shouldn't record this, turn it off. But anyhow, I also think, how did they actually do this? Like there's 14 of us in two tiny rooms, and they were the last to go to bed, and they often slept, and they slept on the table. So anyhow, so technically it's probably Immaculate Conception, maybe that's why. Maybe that's why it worked. But anyhow, but to have a child in the midst of all of that is an amazing sign of hope. Right? A lot of people just gave up. They just collapsed. I mean, they have been betrayed by the government, by the propaganda, by the economy, by everything. Right? You've been betrayed by all these systems. And this is a very powerful sign of hope in the midst of that. And then a couple of years later, my youngest sister, Brita, was born as well. A third quick image. And of course, the birth of Holger was also sort of a desire for the future and a commitment to the future. You're committing yourself. You're going to be raising this child. You're going to be nurturing this child. Right? So you're going to work on improving and healing this place in some shape or form. The third is images of the Church of the Cross, the Kreuzgemeinde. You know, a big, one of these beautiful German churches. But of course, bombed, as most things were in Düsseldorf. And my father would never go to church with us, because the churchyard was also the black market. And my dad on both crutches, right? I mean, after all, he had been on his landmine, he had been in hospital for eight months, then he had to be part of the cripple commando, right? At the very end of the war, all the cripples were still being used. Until his commanding officer said, this is silly, this is just suicide. You know, you're standing with this little metal tube and you're supposed to shoot down American tanks. And of course, this thing only reaches from here to Pat, so you have to wait that the tank, the nostril of the commander of the tank can, you know, look down, and then you're supposed to shoot him, and he was trying to defend the Pied Piper of Hameln, I think was his major assignment, and the Pied Piper didn't show anyhow, so the officer said, I think we can just go, and my father then got an honorable discharge, but still became prisoner of war. Anyhow, just as a tiny background, so he with his war wounds, and he thought it would be permanent, his walking on crutches, didn't go to church, but he was always at church. That was the other thing. And the shoemaker in the congregation saw that we didn't have any shoes. I mean, we had leaky things, right? The toes were leaking out all over the place, like Mark Twain would have loved it. And Huck Finn would have loved it as well, and Tom Sawyer. And he says, why didn't you come over to my cobbler store after church? And so he fitted all of us with used but very, very serviceable shoes. You know, and again, Germany can be cold in the winter. The cantor, they had professional musicians. The cantor, Albert Tate, taught us many songs, and the one that we always still sing is, Lord, remain with us, for night has fallen and the day is almost over. I guess this would be the English translation, Herr bleibe bei uns, denn es will Abend werden. So our family still sings it. You know, all our kids still sing it. The Fieldings and the Mindels always sing it, you know, whatever. It's sung as a round. It's just very, very simple, very beautiful. So we experienced what a faith community can be. A senior civil servant, a Regierungsdirektor or something, so very high up. So the American and the British headquarters were just across the street from us, actually. But of course, they needed German civil service to work, you know, linguistically, and, you know, the government is needs a large machinery to operate. Anyhow, so he would come across, he met us and knew us at church, and he could come across and chat across the fence of this tiny little refugee shelter. And my mother, being a good German-Baltic person, obviously had to offer something. So she offered him cookies. The minor, you know, drawback on the cookie was we and my mom had been gathering acorns in the ruins, and you grind it up, and it makes terribly bitter flour. And he said, excellent, Frau Mündel, you know, could I please have another, you know. So that's an amazing graciousness on his side. Anyhow, so he got to know our family a bit better over the fence, and I don't know how much time it took, and he says, I would like to invite you to take over half of my apartment. And he had lost a son in the war, and so they moved on, you know, it was a two-floor apartment, and so they moved themselves into one floor, and then we had a floor of an apartment to ourselves, which was just amazing. So we experienced what real community was. I mean, they also saw us off at the train station when we started emigrating and all this kind of stuff. As a matter of fact, when we emigrated, the same family, Lucan, gave us a whole set of silverware. You know, once they, you know, it's not classism, but they're conscious of class and, you know, whatever the various classes people have come from and what for them is normal. And a beautiful set of 24 Roman wine glasses. They're called Römer. Don't ever dare to think of drinking red wine with those. They're only for white wine from the Rhine, you know, ideally Riesling. Anyhow, so we had a whole set of silverware and beautiful glasses to emigrate with. And we had such limited stuff, but that came along. And again, beauty and aesthetics is one way of being able to celebrate life. And so, as a matter of fact, the grandchildren, we just visited one of the grandchildren of this Herr Lucan when Pat and I were in Germany. She's a specialist in lung cancers or lung diseases. And the next generation, her children, and my sister's children are closely connected, although, you know, one growing up in Germany, the other growing here. So it's going now into the fourth generation that this kind of community connection carries on. Okay, moving on. We discovered, therefore, the beauty and strength of community, and that actually church is there to support and help each other. In the midst of the ruins, we can't guarantee, we don't control all the big, large economic, political forces, but in the midst of that, there's an amazing amount of stuff we can actually do. The fourth image, skipping to Oliver, B.C. St. John's Lutheran Congregation received us in Oliver. So we arrived after about 7 days of boat ride in St. John, New Brunswick, then about 5 days with a lot of illness, of very dusty trains across Canada, arrived at St. John, and it was Canadian Lutheran World Relief that got various congregations to say, okay, can you find a place for people to stay, and can you find, you know, work for them? And they did that, and so then the pastor and then some German Balts had been working on this, found us a little farm cottage, etc., for us to live. And then every Sunday, he picked us up and brought us to the church. And a lot of German Balts and other immigrants would go to church who in Riga wouldn't have gone to church on a regular basis, because, of course, it was also your cultural ethnic community, right? So it's interesting what happens. And we lived about 5 miles away from Oliver, and so one Sunday nobody could pick us up. So either pastor couldn't, or there's no other parishioners with cars. And so I don't know why that sticks with me, but my dad basically just created his own worship service. I mean, for some people that's very common, but it sort of struck me, you know, and I'm sure we sang The Golden Sonne, so the Golden Sun with joy and delight brings light to our land, would have been one of the hymns. Now thank we all our God would be the another hymn, and praise to the Lord, the Almighty, the King of creation would have been the other hymn. And of course we would sing it all up by memory, like all hymns were learned by memory. Even all folk songs, I could do 150 folk songs when I was 25 or 26, German folk songs by memory, and probably four or five verses. I happened to get together at a conference with a Jewish German woman, and she and I just sang and sang and sang, and the group didn't actually want to do their conference, they just wanted to ask, and she was amazing at harmonizing, and then we just sat down after and just wrote down, and you know, between the two of us we shared. So that's a folk tradition when you can actually share songs with each other, right? Anyhow, so he created worship, and so that was. Worship was very important for my parents. They loved to party. We had amazing parties at our place. They were always nicely organized. They were amazing dancers. Some of us actually inherited that, or learned it, I guess. I didn't pass it on, I'm sorry, to my kids. They're still blaming me for that. Our house was just too small. But we often had out-of-town visitors, and whoever was there, my dad, at the end of the party, and we always closed the party before it deteriorates, which was he says, yeah, you have to shut down a party when it's most fun, when it's most lovely. And then we'd probably sing a few songs together and then end the party. And then he would say, 8 a.m. tomorrow is church. I mean, just so you know, kind of, you know, just for information. And quite a few of us showed. Anyhow. And even in harvest time, thanks for coming, Ray. Even in harvest time, we would... You know, we'd be out in the orchard probably as soon as there was enough light to see the color, because you pick by color when you're picking apricots particularly. And so maybe from 5:30 on, we'd be in the trees. At 8 o'clock, we'd be at church, theoretically in our work clothes. That's not quite how it worked out, but that was the theory. And then after church, we'd be back up in the trees. With apricots, you just can't wait, right? You only have about 6 hours from harvest till it has to be in cold storage, otherwise it's done for. And we had 80 tons of apricots on our orchard initially. Then we diversified it more and more. Anyhow, the other thing we discovered that for my parents, sermons were important. And some of you have heard this, I think it mentioned here at Messiah at some point. My dad distinguished sermons between weak lemonade and black bread sermons. And for a German Baltic person, dark, you know, it's pretty solid, like it's like weapon kind of bread. You can do damage when you throw it at people. But anyhow, dark rye bread is the only real bread, you know. And so when my dad figured this was a lemonade sermon, he would pull out a volume of sermons from Tielicke or Bonhoeffer or Karl Barth and read it to us right after church, Sunday lunch, which was our bigger meal. And of course, a lot of it went, you know. But what it did communicate, I think, very clearly is interpreting scripture is important, and it has to relate to our actual life. It can't be just a bit of a lemonade. Anyhow, next memory. And if you're bored with memories, feel free. In our second Christmas in British Columbia, but another aside on aesthetic, sorry, I never do asides. with the first paycheck that my aunt got, she emigrated with us. So six kids, my mom, dad, and my aunt, who was a midwife, but she couldn't practice, of course, midwifery wasn't allowed. Anyhow, the first paycheck she brought home, they didn't convert it into food or plastic chairs, they didn't exist yet. They bought a piano. So it gives a bit of a sense, right? And my dad, who wouldn't claim he's an artist, but he painted our lone pine tree from Turing's Hope that survived the First War on the walls. And then another corner, he hung pictures of our ancestors. You know, and then they brought two little pieces of furniture from Germany in those crates. And that was the corner where the pictures of the ancestors were. And yeah, so they just always created beauty and always trying to connect. We're not disconnected. We're connected to our history, to our people. Anyhow, so second Christmas in Canada. And for us, Christmas Eve, and for some of you, Christmas Eve is, you know, is the big celebration. And by noon Christmas Eve, I mean, all preparations are done. The whole house is festive, and we never see our Christmas tree until actually after worship, or, you know, we've done the Christmas story, we sung, and then we go into the Christmas room where the doors open automatically. It's, of course, all live candles on the Christmas tree. And then we sing in front of the Christmas tree, and then my dad would lead us to various tables that would have been covered beforehand, which would be our gift tables, and nothing with wrapped gifts or something, and then you can take sort of the image in. But, so we were already, and as kids, you know, you're pretty eager for Christmas Eve to start going, and my dad and mom and we decorated a tiny little Christmas tree, and also with live candles, and took it over to a bachelor farmer, a single farmer, who was in a very un-Christmasly spirit. He was working on his tractor. He had grease all over his hands. The engine was running. And so we planted the Christmas tree, lit it. You know, so there's, I think my mom was busy probably with the Christmas room. It was dad and six kids, you know, surrounding him, singing German songs at him. Poor guy, didn't know what hit him, you know, so he was sort of, you know, looking down all the time, and then we walked away. But but what stuck with me is, obviously for my parents, Christmas was more than cozy feelings in the family. Right? It's the stranger always has to be part of the table. You can't actually have Christmas without a stranger. Right? And anyhow, so, and of course that's a way older Jewish tradition than a Christian tradition, but it's funny that my father picked that up as a crucial, and it stayed. I don't know, I should check with my siblings, you know, how that struck them. But every evening of the 12 days of Christmas, our family would gather and sing. It's always, you know, maybe 50 live candles burning on a tree. Of course, the trees didn't get cut till about the 23rd, so it was actually a fresh tree. And we have a system of monitoring. We only burned two in the house, so it wasn't so bad. But that's when my dad was older, so he did burn himself some in getting the tree out. We paint the room, of course, and redo the carpet and a few other minor details. But it's beautiful, right? I mean, beauty knows no pain. No, but we sang during, and again, they would have probably brought two hymnals, that's it. Two tiny little hymnals from Germany. And so we just sang and sang. And all of this are hymns. My dad said songs, prayer. You know, and then on the second day of Christmas, our neighbors would always come. And for me, it's really, you're in timeless time. If you want a taste of eternity, I think that's what eternity is. Like, time doesn't matter. You don't know, was this 10 minutes? You know, you're not like, okay, when are we done? You know, when would we get to the goodies or something? No, you're just in community. And I think it also expresses, actually, this is maybe what peace on earth is. You know, at least our little taste of peace on earth is through singing. Ardell believes that as well. You know, like, if we could get people to sing more and sing more together, we couldn't do as many stupid things in the world as we do. Anyhow, and then later on, we had an icon painter, a Russian Orthodox woman living on our farm, and she painted icons, and as she got older, they weren't so good anymore. But anyhow, and so we decorated our whole room, our living room, with icons, and then we listened to St. Matthew's Passion. And our neighbors came, and and I didn't know whether you knew this, but mice love St. Matthew's Passion. Everybody's sitting very quietly, very devoutly, you know, listening to the words and the beautiful music and looking at the icon. And then the mice think, okay, well, this is cool. You know, Bach is being played, so let's come out. And our neighbor had a mouse phobia. So our dear neighbor, a German Baron Hahn, realizing the phobia of his wife, how do you do this in a, you know, not disturb Bach and St. Matthew's Passion, right? So he gently dropped himself over the mouse, took it live in his hands, just carried it out very quietly, released it, you know. The mouse probably didn't come back till the next time we did, you know, next Good Friday, but anyhow. But it's not only with all the church festivals, so every Advent, every Christmas, every Lent, every Easter, every Pentecost had its foods, its smells, its sounds. Like for Pentecost, you cut birch trees, you know, and you decorate your space with that. So you have to be included in a visual and a gustatory field. You have to be able to taste it, the celebrations. But way beyond that, they knew how to celebrate. So my dad would celebrate the first icicle. You know, why not? I mean, you have to find reasons for celebrating. And then after a terrible hailstorm probably just wiped out maybe a third of our apple crop, you know, we would celebrate. And because it's just so beautiful. And, you know, when we had urban visitors from Vancouver say, oh, what a tragedy, oh, poor you. No, we're farmers, eh? I mean, you know, we don't control nature and things happen, you know, whatever. So why don't we just celebrate the beauty of this, or even, you know, if you can maybe see some of the hail on the ground and then the beautiful rainbow above and whatever. So celebration was very important. We had many Sabbath days. But Sabbath days wasn't just, you know, go to church. It means playing a lot. You know, we played a lot together, and in the fall particularly, we had two fireplaces in our house. We would, well, I would always lie down. The others would sit probably and listen to stories that my father read up to, you know, till we got older. He read whole novels at supper table, for example. And again, another way, it didn't cost a cent. You know, these books were given to us for free from friends in Germany. So my parents were, as a matter of fact, we would laugh so hard often that we would fall off our chairs at the table, including my dad. My mother would probably, I mean, she had a good sense of humor, but I think falling down at laughter wasn't probably her favorite thing that we did. But it was a bit of a raucous family. And I can see why C.S. Lewis called his autobiography Surprised by Joy. You know, my parents were simply very joyful people. I mean, they had all the hardships, right? But they were very joyful people. And so that joy transcended the hard times, right, that they were going through. And then these were economically very hard times. I don't know whether my dad ever earned more than $11,000. Like, I know he never had to pay income tax. Well, as a good farmer, right, you always lose enough automatically. You know, you don't have to do anything. The global system will do it for you, that you don't have taxable income. And so because he always had taxable income of zero, we had to declare my dad's income when we applied for scholarships. And they didn't quite believe us. But anyhow, but it was good. You got grants and scholarships because, you know, your parents didn't make any money. That's always good. When I got a bit older, we lived in a log house on our orchard, and the room you got depended on what was available and the ages you were in. So some of us lived, you know, two in a room together, et cetera, et cetera. Then my one brother learned to play the tuba or something, so he got moved down the hill into another house with my aunt. You know, etc. But when my oldest brother went to university, then the room right next to the kitchen became free, and so I stayed there. And I discovered, if you want, the secret discipline of my parents. Every morning, actually, they would light the fire, especially in the fall and winter. But for breakfast cooking, we still cooked usually on the wood stove for breakfast. And then they had their coffee, and then they would read, and from the Moravian Brethren's daily readings, that, you know, they are cast by lot, so biblical verses, so you take it sort of as a verse for the day. Then in the fall and winter, they would read, you know, selections from Bonhoeffer. There's a whole breviary, and my father figured the guy who edited it should have gotten, you know, be sainted or something, you know, as a Lutheran saint. I don't know what we do. We don't have to perform miracles. Maybe just edit good books, and then we go into sainthood. Anyhow, and so every day they would read and then reflect on that, but they did it without any fuss before we, as the children, got up or, you know, got into the busyness. And of course, in the summer, things got a bit more hairy. But I'm sure at least they managed the verses, you know, to at least have one verse and probably prayer. So this morning quiet time, they did through their whole married life until my dad died at age 92. That morning, we were still sitting together, and they were still reading, and you know, whatever they were reading. So Bonhoeffer, Luther, Bible, you know, they sort of take turns, you know, and then you don't always do the same thing. And my father read an amazing amount of theological works, as I mentioned before. So in our family, one of the secret Lutheran saints is Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and the reason Bonhoeffer is the family saint is, he was also a very secular person. He was devout, but very secular, very worldly. Played beautiful piano way better than anybody in our family. But whose faith was totally involved in the struggles of, you know, Nazism, smuggling Jews out. You know, ultimately, of course, he got martyred for doing that. So my parents, ironically, you couldn't even call them religious people. They were devout, but they were totally worldly, totally secular in a certain sense, right? It's that interesting. I don't know whether your mind can manage that. But and of course, when Bonhoeffer then tried to articulate when he was in prison, what is a worldly interpretation of Christianity, or a non-religious interpretation of Christianity, where we don't have to make all these religious assumptions? That doesn't mean he wasn't devout. Bonhoeffer kept on praying daily, and you know, and doing all those these things, having his own quiet time. Okay, one more memory, and then a closing. In 1976, then, I'd mentioned that before, my brother died at age 27. He was the one who was taking over the farm. He'd moved onto the farm. My dad, at age 72, was very happy that somebody was already taking over the books and doing planning on the farming. And my dad wanted to be involved to the extent that he could on the orchard. My brother was also a teacher, and so they were testing out a new river, Kettle River, for a school, for canoe trips. And they got bad information. They asked somebody, do people take this branch of the Kettle River? And some say, oh, yeah, all the time. Well, after his death, we discovered, yes, that person had been in that store for a year, didn't have a clue about the rivers. They just wanted to say, you know, what they think the customer wants to hear. Anyhow, if they would have been trained in Augustana, they would have probably found a way of, you know, scanning and navigating. So they came around a corner, and the water just was rushing like crazy, and a steep waterfall. My brother was dead instantly. His partner in the canoe actually survived. So my parents obviously went into serious grief. My mother harder and faster, but she also came out of it faster, in a certain sense. I mean, the rawest part of my grief, of the grief. And my father really sat at the edges. He couldn't listen to music. He wouldn't. He's quite a conversationalist. He didn't pass that on to any of his kids, so we're pretty, you know, monosyllabic most of the time. But, you know, we force ourselves. You know, when there's lots of people, we just think, well, we owe it to them. We should say a few things. But so he couldn't engage in conversation, which is actually his favorite way. That's his way of being, of offering hospitality. And that's the other thing my parents did all their life. Hundreds of people every year would come up to my parents' farm. You know, and later on, whether they were from Vietnam or from France or from Russia or from Germany, it didn't matter. And somehow the word got out and they felt totally at home. So this notion of hospitality, and part of hospitality is actually engaging people in serious conversations about stuff. So my father couldn't do any of those things after my brother's death. But less than a year after his death, the boat people crisis, you know, hit. And so my parents right away said, you know, St. John's congregation should sponsor some of the boat people. And so particularly my dad and my sister went around from person to person in the congregation. I actually had personal conversations, because publicly they heard a lot of the Yellow Peril, you know, and the Asian takeover or whatever, all these horrific things that were going to happen. And so they were chatting with all these people, and people would say, oh, there's no way we should have them, you know, because, you know, I've read somewhere, you know, this is, you know, the yellow peril, or this will do this, or this will do all the other terrible things. But when they come, you know, we have a bed that you guys could use, you know, or when they come, well, we could give a fridge, or we could give a stove. So it's interesting that our minds often are more screwed up than our heart. You know, we can actually still do the human thing, even though in our mind we have all this defense against it. And lo and behold, a whole family of Vietnamese ended up on my parents' farm. And all of a sudden, their family actually was expanded. Then the woman got paralyzed in a car accident. And so she, with a wheelchair, and her husband, and a child who now has his PhD and I think is living in Toronto, grew up on the farm. When any birthdays happened, there would be always some Vietnamese grandchildren phoning, and of course their English is fluent, right? I mean, because they were raised here, and so they're trying to figure out which one of the grandchildren. The Vietnamese grandchildren would never fail. And then there was a single Vietnamese person who had been in the jungles for 5 years, surviving till he found his way into Thailand, and then he was held sort of in prison. Took a lot of letter writing on my dad's part, and then together with the Roman Catholic priest, they finally got him over. But of course, he has all the post-traumatic stress, all the war trauma to deal with. And again, he, you know, my dad nurtured him through school, you know, and, you know, he actually got a college degree, but ended up, I think he's a roofer, better money in Toronto with that as well. So, for me, that again expresses, regardless of how you feel in a certain sense, you have to respond to the concrete needs of people, and that in itself will enrich your life. So that, if you want, that's another sign of hope. The last thing I want to mention is my dad created our own family crest, and we've got lots of heraldic material in our various families. And he ignored all of them, and so he drew, as I mentioned, he drew it on the wall of our first little cabin. He drew I had a graphic artist in Vancouver then do it, but he drew the lone pine tree, and then around it he wrote Carpe Diem, but not the way, you know, you can do that with bullish force, you know, seize the day, you know, with force, but actually it's from Ephesians 5, if I'm, you know, seize the day or use the day wisely, for they are evil times, is the full quote. And that's, you know, my dad was very important. So that became the family crest, and I think that guided them through their whole life. We have to seize the day, which means seize it because there's a rainbow. Time to celebrate, you know, there's an icicle. You know, we're snowed in, we can't do anything. Well, let's read, let's play, let's do whatever, right? Let's listen to music, let's dance, you know, all of these kinds of things. But seizing the day, but within evil times, we have to seize it with ours, we have to use that time fully. The Spanish has a nice word, aprovechar. Make full use of the time that is given to you to love, to serve, to build community, to heal, and to enjoy. And so my dad definitely subscribed to Luther's motto, even if the world ends tomorrow, I would still plant my tree today. There's a beautiful book by Jean Giono. I don't know whether you know it. It's The Man Who Planted Trees. It's worth getting. And so here's somebody who basically was a shepherd in France. The two wars passed him by. He was up herding his sheep and always planting trees. Actually, most of them oak. And after the Second World War, people went, wow, all of a sudden the water starts coming back. You know, there's live streams flowing through these villages all of a sudden, which had been totally desertified. Well, because Jean, very quietly, or not Jean, the person he's writing about, had been quietly doing his planting trees. As I mentioned, my dad, for the last 2 decades of his life, that's basically what he did. He created beauty. He created a park around our house and just planted trees. And my mother nurtured children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren and neighbors' children. And when she was in her dying time at age 96, when my little niece came by, Maya, even though she wasn't that conscious most of the time for most other people, she would burst in a smile still. So both nurtured. I think both did the same thing. One does it with trees, the other one does it with children. So for me, that's what shaped my theology of hope. Thank you.
Line, and you fulfilled it in such a remarkable way. Use the day wisely. As you know, Dittmar is formally retiring. The whole idea of that strikes fear in an administrator's heart, I'm sure. It certainly doesn't mean departure or not being engaged by any means. And we know that, and welcome, and are glad for that. The Ronning Center, we wanted to use this evening to gather some of you and to spend a little time honoring our friend and colleague, Dittmar and Pat, who have together made such a lovely place of this place. So we've asked a few people to speak a little bit to that. I would like to call on Bishop Don Schoberg first.
Well, thank you, Dittmar. I've known you for many years, but I know you even better now. I remember the first time I heard you speak in the 60s, and it was a youth gathering. And the text you chose was from Isaiah. He made me a polished arrow. In his quiver, he hid me away. And I wondered, why on earth is he using that for these young people? But then he developed that idea of being a polished arrow, useful. And well, it speaks of being hidden away, that is only for the good time when you are able to minister or to put your talents to use. And I have followed your ministry through the years, and you've always been a teacher. And so there's another part of Isaiah that I'm not sure if you use this, but I would like to think that you also use that. The Lord God has given me the tongue of a teacher, that I may know how to sustain the weary with a word. Morning by morning he wakens my ear to listen as those who are taught. Wherever you've been, you've taught. Even your examining committee, they asked them a question about the virgin birth. And I was wondering who was examining whom. And in Edmonton, as a parish pastor. And then in Vancouver, Church of the Cross. And one of the things he insisted on was that there should be opportunity for the members to go to camp, to a church camp. And I was there the one time, and guess what? We studied Luther's Large Catechism. And there was singing. Yes, there was singing and delightful conversation. There was even a mouse in one of the rooms. Lively conversation is part of the Mindel household. And Pat, you have brought that. I was thinking of all the ways in which the arrow has been polished with your tradition, the ancestral grace that's yours. And of course, Pat came at one of the youth gatherings and been part of your life. We were with the Berettas, friends of yours, about 2 weeks ago, and they were remembering the time that the Mindel family visited them in Toronto. And they spoke about the lively conversation. It was nonstop, but only broke for singing in four-part harmony. A delightful picture of the Mindel household, which follows that tradition of your mother and father. I was privileged to be in their home one time, and it was a little bit of ice on that road going up to your house. And your father drove that Subaru like a German tank. That's right. And I stayed in your aunt's home and was amazed at the books I saw at the front of the bed there. So you really have given us another glimpse of yourself with that wonderful tradition that is yours. And here in Camrose, you have found the right place, because here there's been a podium, many podiums for you. And your retirement doesn't mean it's your time of teaching, of being a prophetic voice for us, of being a scholar, is not ending by any means. So I wish you God's blessing. And the Lord has indeed given you the tongue of a teacher, that you may know how to sustain the weary with the word. Thank you.
I should add one thing. Don always won at the cherry spitting contest that we had in Vancouver. And we tried to spit it over the two-story roof of the parsonage. And I think Don was the only one who could do it.
It's a whole new indication of what qualifies you for bishop. We could have 1,000 students come and speak. So on behalf of all of them, we've asked Carmela Moore.
He's known as many things. Professor, gardener, pastor, parent, neighbor, friend. Dietmar Mundell is all of these and more. And I first knew Dietmar as professor. It was 2008, and I walked into Religion 263, the course known for turning your life upside down. And in my case, it was the course that turned my life upside down and right into the soil. So I first knew Dietmar as professor. Not too long after, I began to see that Dietmar was also student. A student of his students, of his family, of his community, and of these lands. And this is, of course, part of what makes his life, his presence in each of our lives, so transformational. He values your life experience as true and beautiful and hard and worthy of listening to and learning from. Dietmar, the student, is the one who sits beside you in class, despite how unconventional or unpopular it might be, because to him, you are everything that matters. As time passed, I began to know Dietmar as gatherer. Through his efforts, students, staff, community members, strangers are brought together, and usually over a potluck. Dietmar gathers us, reminding us that together we are the most sacred version of ourselves, reminding us that only together can we create the kinder future about which we all dream. And like a good shepherd, when one of us goes a-wandering, Dietmar goes and searches for the one. He goes and cares for the path that brings the lost sheep home, back home into community. Dietmar is our great gatherer. As more years passed, I became witness to Dietmar as a great parent and partner. I also came to know him as visionary, so rooted to this place and in tune with his tomato plants. Dietmar is a prophetic voice among us. And he is servant heart also. Day after day, year after year, he chooses his path based on what is good for all. And we all know Dietmar Mundell as one of the world's great storytellers. But most of all, I know Dietmar as friend. And for this, I give thanks most of all. Dietmar teaches the hearts of students. And to him, as you've heard, true knowledge, good knowledge, is the lived experience. It's what one comes to know in community. As his student, I received credit for sharing meals and conversation, for sitting with creek beds and wheat fields and expressing what they mean to me, for listening to stories. I received credit for getting to know and fall in love with place and all place holds. And he speaks about this as the starting place. It's a place from which we can respond to suffering of our earth, of its creatures. Begin, he says, in love with the land and its fullness thereof. Come see it. Come listen to it. Come know it. And then you won't be able to help but fall in love with it. And thus we work for change not because we understand we have to, but because we love to. And as is the depth of partnership between soil and water, so too is the partnership between Pat and Dietmar. Pat and Dietmar acknowledge the vital importance and beauty of the commonplace and common person. They choose to see the fullness of each person they encounter, nurturing the caring spirit within each of us. As we know, in their presence, we become more beautiful, more fully ourselves. For what more could a friend, a student, a son, daughter, or neighbor ask. They are advocates for ordinary life. They recognize that the small, daily acts of kindness are the greatness to which we are called. And they teach us that we, as beings made of the earth, are made exactly for this task, made for the task of living a radically ordinary life of kindness. Each year, the red tomatoes that speckle the garden of the Mundells' home remind us that to be a gardener is to believe in tomorrow. To be a gardener of tomatoes or a gardener of communities is to have faith that the rising of the setting sun comes on the morrow. Desde siempre y para siempre. So as a gardener, neighbor, parent, student, professor, and my friend, Dittmar embodies that beautiful message. We've been blessed to be witness to the one wild, beautiful life you live. Thanks for teaching us that there's always hope beneath our feet. Thank you, Pat and Dittmar.
Roger Epp spent a number of years with Dittmar here at Augustana, so we'd like him to say a few words.
Not sure if I was invited here to be to speak for the past administrators who had to catch up to your plans. I don't think so. Appreciate the chance to be here to hear Dittmar speak personally about your own formation and to say a few words in your honor. There are many things that could be said, many dimensions of a long career of a fellow teacher and colleague and friend that are worth celebrating. Just finished a co-edited book project. You can ask Milton about it. That asks what it is to train as a doctoral student at one of the select intellectual capitals of the world and then be dispatched, as the anthropologist Clifford Geertz once said, as exiles from Eden to go teach at places that couldn't be imagined in those intellectual capitals, to campuses that put a priority on undergraduate teaching, to campuses located in small, rural, out-of-the-way places, to campuses that don't even have the luxury of imagining themselves as ivory towers. And it's not an easy adaptation. And Dittmar is someone who has shown how it can be done, how you can live an integrated life in that way. So what comes to mind quickly, and I'll be disciplined about this, a couple of things. I think it was in my very first year at a place that was still then called CLUC, or temporarily called CLUC, when the bookstore was in the basement. You kind of had to get to it in the way that you got to this place. And I remember noticing in the racks, maybe it was a kind of something that had been used as a course pack or a single essay the year before. It was still for sale. And it was something that Dittmar had written, photocopied, I think. And it started with a paradox. I don't know why I was there flipping through what was on the probably the discount racks. Started with a paradox, and a paradox is a word that has a couple of meanings in the academy. Sometimes it genuinely means the holding together of truths that seem incommensurable, but somehow they fit. Sometimes it's a polite way of saying that something doesn't really make sense. And so I remember the essay started with a paradox, that here we have a society that prizes individualism and choice. But why do we all make the same choices? Why do we want to do the same thing with it? Why does our age of individualism generate such mass consumer conformity? Which I thought was a pretty good question. I remember it after all these years. But I'd also want to say that, on the one hand, Dittmar is not one of those individualists. He is someone who believes deeply, as you've heard, in community, who lives that out. But, and here's the paradox, the real kind, he's a one-of-a-kind person. And all of us who care about the Academy and its future have to care that there continues to be room for people who are one-of-a-kind professors. I'm not really pessimistic about that. I think there are, but they need examples. So the other thought that came to mind was that Dittmar comes from the same Baltic German world as the political theorist Hannah Arendt. She from Königsberg, a family that was nominally Jewish. And intellectually, as we've heard, she did her work under the same profound shadow of the Nazi experience. Who could think as if that hadn't happened? And it was Arendt who tried to understand evil. How could it be? How could it be if it maybe wasn't what Kant and the Kantians thought, something a radical kind of disruption? What if evil was done by those who simply went along, who did not think for themselves? The respectable people were the worst. In an essay in 1954 called The Crisis in Education, Arendt spoke to the point about teaching, the future, and the responsibility we dare not abdicate in a way that I thought was very fitting for this evening. This is how she ends that essay. Arendt came to the United States in probably about 1940 from France, so was a stranger in a way, making her way in a new country. So in The Crisis of Education, she concludes, and I'll read this slowly. Education is the point at which we decide whether we love the world enough to assume responsibility for it, and by the same token, save it from that ruin which, except for its renewal, except for the coming of the new and young, would be inevitable. And education, too, is where we decide whether we love our children, and we might add our students, enough not to expel them from our world and leave them to their own devices, nor to strike from their hands their chance of undertaking something new, something unforeseen by us, but to prepare them in advance for the task of renewing a common world. Thank you for taking on that responsibility for all of us.
I suppose one of Dittmar and Pat's oldest students in the room is Karsten. Karsten. And Karsten will be followed by Dean Berger and an invitation to the reception. Karsten.
Good evening, everybody. My father got an hour, he got an hour. He took an hour and a half to talk about lessons from his parents, so I will also do the same. So I hope you're comfortable in your seats there. I wanted to reflect on two key lessons from my parents, and one being the importance of relationships and community to learning, and you've heard about that in multiple occasions already this evening. And secondly, that this happens both in the classroom and outside of the classroom. And I want to use 2.5 stories to get there. One of my earliest memories as a child is being banished to my room at night, and maybe I'm projecting backwards or forwards now, having small children of my own, but I was stuck in my room as the house was filled with laughter and games and so on from the students that my parents would welcome into our home. And so they would be playing dice, cards, singing, but also, you know, pulling out dictionaries and things like that, and a way of building community out of the classroom, out of the school, and ways that, as Carmel was saying, sort of defy that traditional teacher-student relationship. And so sometimes as we were learning from the pastor how to lie really well at this dice game that we played, you know, what better teacher than a pastor to teach about lying. You can ask later. But often the conversation would veer to disputes with the most recent theological lecture series speaker, and he got it all wrong or she got it all right, or topics or conversations around issues of the day. And so this was a way to talk in ways that were much more real than were necessarily possible in a classroom. The second story I'd like to share is the great Grant writing extravaganza of 1991. That is a thrilling topic, I'm sure. You all can hardly wait to hear what happens. And any past or current deans of Augustana should probably close their ears. But we took over all of the second floor of Founders Hall, all of the computers and all of the printers, to prepare a grant for what became the Ghana program and then the Mexico program and those that you heard about this evening. So as children, we don't actually remember most of that. We were playing games on the stairs and playing school. There's a whole bunch of classrooms just ready for us there and chalkboards. And so I will claim that I was doing serious work on the computers and getting the printers to work and that it was mostly my sisters doing... Oh, yes, and I stole candies from Betty's desk. That's right, yes. I apologize now. The truth will out, apparently. And so as we finished this grant, this mad rush, a little bit of playing involved, we drove madly to Edmonton and were successful, and that ultimately ended up in that program that you've already heard about, and actually spawned the international activities, study abroad activities at Augustana that now see 1 in 3 of our graduates graduating with a significant international experience. And that's sort of a result of that mad grant writing day. And that requires additional funding to help us get out there and do that kind of work. The final story that I'd like to share is one that I welcome you to help me continue to write or help us continue to write. A group of us have been thinking, how do we honor this work of my parents? And on the occasion of my father's retirement from Augustana. And I was thinking actually a toaster, an engraved toaster with some Luther or something written on it was excellent. So I don't know if, did somebody, no. But I was overruled by my wife Dina, who was unfortunately unable to be here, and others wiser than myself. And so given my parents' commitments to fostering community, and relationships often outside of the classroom, We thought a way to continue that tradition would be to endow a fund so that kind of activity could continue. And so this story is only partly written because what we're able to achieve depends on what we're able to collectively commit to that endeavor. So we've started a fund with the Battle River Community Foundation, tentatively titled the Koinonia Fund. Don't tell Dana Andreas and I, she doesn't know about that name yet. And the idea is that it will facilitate the kinds of learning experiences that you've heard about this evening. And we'll be able to do so for a long time into the future. So recent examples would be the kinds of internships that Odessa Shcherbanek did in Guatemala, or Leah is going to Colombia. She's also looking for money to go to Colombia this summer. Or as soon to be coming to you through the Ronning Center program of junior fellow or junior fellowships or junior scholars at the Ronning Center. So ways that encourage this kind of pedagogy, theology that you've heard about this evening. So we're aiming to endow the fund initially at $100,000, and we're about a quarter of the way there now. And this is the first sort of public announcing of this initiative. If you are interested in contributing, please come and find me after the event, or look to Ronning Center Communications that will be in your inboxes or mailboxes soon. Thank you.
This has really been an inspiring evening. David and Rebecca, thank you both for organizing it. Messiah, thank you for hosting it. Thank you. Thank you to all of the respondents tonight, and of course, thank you mostly, Dietmar. I haven't known Dietmar and Pat nearly as long as most of you, in fact, just a short 2.5 years. But in that time, they've both been inspirations to me. The easiest job that I have as dean, and Roger knows this well, the easiest job that I have is to share the vision of undergraduate liberal arts and science education. I do it all the time. I've done it for over 30 years. I share the vision with prospective students, with prospective donors, with current students, with current donors, with alumni, with community members. I talk about things like liberal education, being liberating, as Dietmar knows and Paulo Freire said, from circles of certainty and cultures of silence. I talk about, beyond critical thinking, the loftier goals of liberal education, like moral formation, the need to help students develop virtues, the need to build character and help students gain a sense of vocation. In other words, the moral and social purposes of education. I talk about leadership development and how it's connected to the cultivation of certain habits and dispositions and ability to communicate vision and belongingness, to work effectively in diverse teams, a capacity for courage and humility, and tonight especially, I should add, hope. I talk about the limitations of a view of higher education that sees it narrowly as career preparation, as a commodity that is purchased by individuals for narrow instrumental reasons, rather than as a shared civic obligation and a worthwhile societal investment. I talk about the need to extend the classroom into the real world, into the community, where our neighbors, whether they live in Camrose or live in Mexico, become our co-teachers and our co-learners. These are the things I talk about. And it is, as I said, an easy job because talk is cheap. The harder job is walking the talk, is trying to ensure that the reality of liberal education lives up to the rhetoric. And here at Augustana, that harder job is made significantly easier by the lived examples of Dittmar and Pat Mundell. They are inspirations, I know, to many of you, and in the short time I have known them, they have been daily inspirations to me. And they, along with others who share their values and commitments, make me very proud to be associated with Augustana. So, Dittmar and Pat, I simply want to close with two words echoing all the other respondents, but also what everyone here is feeling in their heart. Thank you. We have wonderful refreshments, I'm told, from the Lepsa House, and so I want to invite all of you to stay to enjoy the refreshments, enjoy the conversation, enjoy this time together. Thanks for coming.